Good morning, everyone. Coming to you live from somewhere in the Middle East, it is Saturday morning's hottest streaming media political talk show, Inside the Eye, live with The Fedge. Did I just hear someone tell a standing member of Congress that if it were up to them, they would dump the Israelis tomorrow? Sounds like something you might hear right here on Inside the Eye Live.
The Fetch. What a man. Oh, my God. You have to listen to that show. He was brilliant. I didn't know he had gonads of steel like that and a mind like a frigging razor. I didn't realize he was so clear. He cut through this that cognitive dissonance that is going on in the whole Patriot music movement.
And now it's time for Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware. All right, everybody, from Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, this is The Fetch, and you are live Inside the Eye. Today's date is Saturday, December the 16th, 2017, and a good Saturday morning to all of you listening in the United States and Canada, and a good late afternoon to evening to all of you listening in European and Asian time zones, and of course, wherever you are listening out there on the World Wide Web or our FM and micro FM broadcasting outlets. May all be well with you and yours. The weather today here in Riyadh was certainly on the cool side as daytime highs hit only about 65 degrees. However, the high of 65 really was a bit deceptive, as having gone out today and really just a short sleeve golf style sport shirt, I soon found out that the 65 degrees, which is actually quite comfortable in my book, was quite a bit cooler and colder in the shade. So consequently, I could be seen today scouting out areas of sunshine as I waited for a driver to pick me up and take me back to the hotel this afternoon. Now, with sunset coming at 5:08 this evening or afternoon, the current temperature now has obviously gone down. We're sitting at about 58 degrees with a moderate wind of around 11 miles per hour out of the north-northwest around the useful part of the evening, which I regard about 1 o'clock a.m. locally on a day like today. The temperature should be around 49 degrees, while we should reach an ultimate nighttime morning low of 45 degrees in the hour before sunrise. So all in all, Riyadh continues to greet everybody with some very nice weather, and the pattern should continue out for a week or so as daytime highs and lows should each rise about 5 degrees beginning this coming Monday and then on out into next weekend. So it's going to be very nice, and then they're projecting higher temperatures for Christmas here. So, of course, they don't practice Christmas here. In fact, I see very, very few, if any, displays of Christmas here. But nonetheless, it's coming, everybody. 9 days of shopping left, essentially, full days of shopping. I recall back in my day, you know, I was dumb. You know, I would wait till the very last minute to do shopping, and I would be like heading on into the Glendale Galleria. And I'd be like hunting for parking and all the headache and mess. Folks, I don't miss that at all, to be honest with you. In fact, I saw, just to let you know how us older people change over time, there was something like a survey taken about Christmas trees, live Christmas trees, and people 60 years and older, 83% did not plan to buy a Christmas tree this year, believe it or not. And I think it was something like, what did I say? I should have said 83%. I don't know what I said. 83%. If I didn't say that it was 83, I'm going off the top of my head. It was like 58% of those 30 to 60, something like that. There was only three breakdowns, or maybe it was 40 and 40 to 60. And then I think it was like 18 to 39 was something like they were 60% plus most likely to buy a Christmas tree. So there you go. Big change as you get a bit older. The holidays change and the meanings change as the kids grow up and get out. So this year, I think Christmas shopping in America is going to be down a little bit. Maybe it's going to be a year-on-year rise, but average ticket per sale or something like that is going to be going down. And we'll just see how it works when the season ends. But nonetheless, everybody, you got a few more days to go to finish your Christmas shopping. I know today I actually, the reason I was out was because I can't be there with everybody. I'm sending just basically some money to help. I sent money to the Philippines, to Jordan, to America today, and just kind of like finalize that just to get some, you know, it is the holiday of cheer. So what I can do is, obviously, people would honestly much rather have me around than money. That's a good thing to hear on the table. But that's kind of what I did today. I was out sending money, different locations to try to spread a little bit of cheer in that way, even though we can't be there. Being in the expat world, at least we can let people know we're thinking about you. So happy holidays, Merry Christmases, and all that. Certainly go into the season with good cheer and health. That's all we usually ask. You know, I've got this is what, December 16th, everybody. We've got really, two more weeks to go. And then I'll be heading back to Jordan early January for a couple weeks, maybe 2 to 3 weeks. Not sure exactly how long yet. I got to check flights and schedules and all that, commitments and all that kind of cool stuff. But yeah, we're looking to get out of here for the start of the new year. I'll still be here at the start of the new year, but I'm looking to get back and visit some family soon, go see the cats. Got a fun cat story. But yeah, looking forward to getting out of here also myself. But overall, no complaints. I've been having a good time this year. Business is okay, and the work's been good, so I can't complain. I know I get a lot of headache from you guys, some of you guys out there, for being in Saudi Arabia. And I know it's hard for people to grasp the geopolitics and people and try to separate it, but we do our best. We do our best. Let's see. Where do we want to start today's show? Let's kind of start with where we started last week, because it's actually still pertinent. We know in California, again, fire season really starts to die down. It gets really big in the summer months. And by October, after the Santa Ana winds die down, the fire seasons usually start to die off. But they've got a fire going now in California known as the Thomas Fire. It's near a city called Fillmore. It's in an area where I would actually take my car and my bicycle as a young guy, and I would kind of like sleep in my car, because this is very pristine. It's very pristine, at least it was 20 years ago. A beautiful area, beautiful part of California, hilly. And I would go camp out somewhere, take my bike, and I would just go for 20, 30, 40-mile bike rides out in these areas. And this fire, it's been raging now since, I think, December the 4th, something like that. It's cost so far over $97 million to fight this. It's now claimed its first firefighter victim. It's up to 259,000 acres. Thousands of firefighters have been working around the clock. Helicopters, airplanes are being used to drop retardant on the flames. You know, growing up in California, of course, we have these forest fires. And this was kind of like the height of the Cold War, the 1960s and 70s. So, you know, one of the things actually as kids we would do, at least I would do, is we would kind of like be like airplane spotters. We kind of knew which type of aircraft are flying in the sky, and you could always see the firefighting aircraft, because they always had a red, not red tipped, but they had a very large red stripe going across the wing, not horizontal with the wing, but across the wing. And so you would look up, you say, oh, that aircraft is heading to fight one of the fires that might have been brewing out there or cooking out there or, whatever you want to say, but basically out there. Yeah. So we would always check that. So I can't imagine what they're doing now. I'm sure they've probably got the same color patterns. But planes and helicopters have long been part of the arsenal of fighting fires in California for sure. Again, we're up to like 259,000 acres as of Saturday, today, surpassing now the 257,000 acres that was in the California Rim Fire in 2013. So now this is the third largest fire. And it's not that it's the third largest fire in California history. That's not such a big deal in some respects. You know, it's prone to fires. But you know what? If you know California like a lot of us do, the fact that this is happening in December is absolutely unheard of. They're still having Santa Ana winds. That doesn't, of course, help. You've got, whenever you have Santa Ana winds, you're going to have the embers, these hot embers, rising up with the wind and being blown, who knows, 100, 200, 500, 600, a mile away. And that makes it very, very difficult. Now, we'd like to announce the guy's name that died is Corey Iverson. He's a 32-year-old guy, died Thursday up in Ventura County in the community of Fillmore. Firefighters have said that Iverson, his blaze, once again, was the first fatality. And his wife was pregnant, and he also has a 2-year-old daughter. So that's going to be really a tough, tough, tough time for that family come this Christmas. You might want to think of them a little bit. So it's been pretty nasty in California with all of these fires, to say the least. Today, as we went in yesterday, again, high winds were affecting that fire. There's, of course, multiple fires are continuing to burn in California. Hundreds of structures have been burned. I think there's over 760 homes have gone up in flames in this Thomas fire. So for a lot of people on the western side of the nation, especially along this area, we're dealing with a lot of stress for the holidays. It might be a great holiday season for a lot of us, but for those in these areas, it's really, I'm sure, quite difficult. Friday night, Saturday, they're talking gusts of 40 to 60 miles per hour, more down trees, more down power lines, relative humidity only 10 to 20%. And under these conditions, you're talking about extreme, extreme fire hazards. And so what can you say? You look at some of the areas that have burned now on a map and the areas where the fires are, you're talking about a huge amount of acreage that have gone up, and the distance where these fires are is quite impressive as far as the range of the fires. Now, apparently in my old hometown, Los Angeles, they haven't been having too many strong winds. Downtown LA is kind of sheltered by a little bit of onshore breeze from the ocean plus the mountains. So if the wind isn't quite strong enough to push through the mountains, LA might find itself somewhat sheltered, and that is expected to happen again this weekend. But for all you guys and gals on the California coast, I guess the rose section, I'm not sure where the roses are grown, but there's a section of California where you got a lot of roses, and of course the rose parade's coming up, and that was spared. That didn't happen. Saw another story about California. California is kind of a strange place. They're now looking very close to now legalizing recreational sale of marijuana. And because of that, you're going to be able to buy a rosé. That's right, a California wine called Rebel Coast. I'm giving you guys some advertising here, guys. Called Rebel Coast, and it's going to be a marijuana or a cannabis-infused alcoholic wine. And that is, of course, going to take effect when some new regulations in the state go into effect. Rebel Coast Rebel Coast Winery will launch the new line with a marijuana-infused Sauvignon Blanc infused with 4 milligrams of THC per serving, which takes about 15 minutes to feel the effects of, according to the winery. And because the alcohol is removed from the wine, you don't have to worry about any hangovers. So essentially, it's going to be a THC alcohol-free wine, and that should be kind of interesting. I don't know if I would drink that, but it sounds interesting. Winemakers have been making infused wines for years, of course, but no one's really developed a reliable method of removing alcohol and then infusing it with cannabis. So that's going to be a new thing, and its co-founder is Alex Howe. I'm going to assume he's not Jewish. In the coming year, Rebel Coast plans to also release a rosé, a sparkling wine, and a few others. So, guys, things are changing in California, aside from the nonsense that goes on with immigration and everything else around that subject. California still has many creative, intelligent people. Of course, we've had a situation now going on with the NFL. If you're not familiar with America, we've got a sports league. Of course, most of you are American listening. But we have the National Football League, and it was a corporate juggernaut for quite a number of years. I remember back in the 90s, I sold or helped sell around $43,000 worth of advertising for KFWB. And KFWB provided for that advertiser, if they closed the deal within a certain time, the advertiser was given like VIP tickets to the Super Bowl and pre-Super Bowl parties and post-Super Bowl parties and all kinds of stuff that went along with that advertising. But the NFL has taken a hit. As you know, the NFL has been working, apparently, especially the NFL Players Union, has been working with George Soros, at least that's as some reports have gone. And now in California and Texas, or I shouldn't say in California and Texas, but NFL, you know, how do I say this without getting ahead of the story here? The NFL has a problem with its players. You're talking about it's a heavily demographic, African-American, if you want to call them that, league. A lot of them have taken a stand against, quote-unquote, police brutality. But, of course, they are talking often about things where the police aren't really at fault. There's lots of police brutality. I know the story about Daniel Shaver, a white guy, came home a little bit drunk, was met with police inside of his own motel. And if you've seen that video with all the stupidity of the police barking orders at him, do this, do that, do this, do that, it, completely unnecessary, uncalled for. And then the guy, the police guy, officer was found. You can't even call him an officer, a police executioner, an executioner in a police uniform. He was found not guilty. And, of course, the message that sends is that I guess if you're a white person in America, there you don't can't expect too much help from the courts anymore. So the NFL's been players, that is. They've been talking, you know, doing a lot of protesting and not standing for the national anthem and all this. And, of course, the base of the NFL is largely a white, traditional American. That would be white people, you know, the normal European stock of America. That's really who supports and pays for the NFL. And so the NFL, let's be honest, they've been giving the American people the finger now for a couple of years, beginning with Colin Kaepernick a year or two ago. So you've got lots of protests going on. The NFL is cratering. I personally would like to see it completely crash. And now it's being reported that four teams are the ticket price for the teams, this is NFL, are actually selling cheaper than California and Texas high school games, if you can imagine that. Let me see if I can get more details on that. Tickets, again, so where is this? Where if I can see that? The LA Times found that tickets on secondary seller Vivid Seats Thursday morning for Sunday's Dolphins-Bills matchup in Buffalo going for $12. That's a premium compared to Cardinals at the Redskins, Ravens at Browns, and last night's what they called a dud fest between the Broncos and the Colts. Tickets could be had for as low as $5 for each of those games. Can you imagine? $5 to go. Now, honestly, I wouldn't pay $5 to go to see an NFL game. And for those of you who are rabidly into the NFL, look, I don't have a problem with it per se, but just my experience is this. I have been to professional NFL games. I've been to baseball games. I have not, quite frankly, been to hockey, believe it or not, even though I love the sport. I love to watch it even on TV. I think it's very well covered. But when I look at NFL football and football in general, guys, I don't know how you can go watch the game and be oh so excited. There's like 11 and a half minutes of actual action, actual play, in a game that takes 3 hours and 11 minutes or a little over 3 hours to play. How can you get guys, I can't stand it. It's like they play and then you just wait. And then they play and you wait. And there's so much downtime, so much TV commercial time. I can't even go to the game and not fall asleep. I really can't. It bores. If I want to sleep during the day, I just download an NFL game. Really, I just download an NFL game. What a boring product. I just don't find it a quality product. And that's true. Heck, I went. You know, I tried to get into Super Bowl fever and all that kind of stuff. I tried, boy. And I went to the Super Bowl, and I went to a restaurant, and everybody's all excited and gung-ho, and I'm trying to get in. I'm a sports fan, guys. I love sports. You can't accuse me of not liking sports here. But I went, and I swear, by the time the halftime of that game came along, I wanted to sleep. I'm like, man, I want to go home. This is boring the hell out of me. And everyone's so excited. And I'm like, what is it that you guys see that I'm missing here? I tried so long to get into the NFL. So it is really great to see, quite frankly, that we've got a situation now where the NFL is not even able to sell on the secondary market for $5. And I wouldn't pay it. Because once I got there, I'm going to be tempted to buy their concessions at a ridiculous price, and I wouldn't want to do it and be inconvenienced, and I can't sleep because I'm there. So I don't know, guys. The ticket prices are crashing. The stadiums are empty. And that, again, is something we should, as a nationalist front, seek to break all of these Jewish-owned monopolies, especially basketball, especially the NFL, those that are taking a demographic stand against the American people. And again, the American people are the traditional European Americans. I am all for that. Join me in the chat room. I'm actually not there. I'm not there at all. I haven't received any messages. Let me head over there right now. InsideTheEyeLive.com /live chat. That's right. InsideTheEyeLive.com/live chat. You can also get there by InsideTheEyeLive.com. Click on the live chat button, and that will also get you in the door. So I'm there now. I think it's loading. The page is loading, everybody. It's kind of coming along. Let me see here. There's one eye. One eye is there. And yes, the chat room is blowing along. And aside from this advertisement, which is annoying, it's actually taking over the page. I got to get rid of that advertising if you guys keep doing that to me. Anyways, guys, I see the chat room. Everybody's talking. Hanshan's there. So, guys, again, you know, BB, get in touch with me. Blackbird, if you're in the chat room, get in touch with me. The phones are working today, everybody. 1-323-275-1314. That's 1-323-275-1314. I am Lone Frog, Wolfgang, Hanshan, Nick Dolin. Those are the ones that are on the screen right now. So guys, we've already got 19. That's great. 19 people in the chat room. And then Nick Dolin. In fact, Nick Dolin puts an interesting point in the chat room here. He's saying that the NFL recently agreed to spend nearly $90 million over the next 7 years to various organizations connected with social justice causes. Several of those groups have deep connections to billionaire liberal activists, actually traitor George Soros. So, folks, everybody's starting to get the game here. Everybody's trying to position themselves now for the long haul. And if you're not thinking long haul and this long effort by the Jewish community to destroy the West, you're just not getting with the times here, folks. There must be more activity on your part to assist in this long game, for sure. I'll tell you, let's see, I got about a minute to two to go. This week I was doing the Inside the Eye Live primetime show, and I don't know what I was doing again. The primetime show for me, folks, it's actually kind of a difficult a difficult show to get done. You know, I thought it was going to be an easy show to do, but it occurs on Thursday night. But the problem now is I've been quite busy with my Thursday nights. So I've been trying to put together, well, we are doing the best we can for that matter. But we are trying to really, we are going to have to start to do a little bit more research. We've been getting criticized in a positive way about how, you know, we need to start doing more research. But I'll tell you what, the work here has been great, guys. We've been having a great time trying to figure out what's going on here in the Middle East. And we got some information, of course, coming up after the break here, which should be coming up pretty soon. I'm pretty sure the phone lines again are working, 1-323-275-1314. That's 1-323-275-1314. Now, Blackbird, I tried to bring him on last week on Inside the ILI Primetime, and we just had a really bad connection. So I'm going to try to bring on Blackbird maybe in hour number two. Blackbird, you don't know this yet, but you're now a professional business. Stand by if you're available. We'd like to get you on to talk to you about Hanukkah and some of the Talmudic stuff going on inside of the current world order structure. It's the Fetch Inside the ILI. Intelligent media for the politically aware. Back with more right after this. All right, everybody, welcome back. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware. Again, today's date, December 16th, 2017. Good Saturday morning to all of you listening again in the United States and Canada. Good late afternoon to evening to everybody listening in European and Asian time zones. So, again, it's that time. Oh, you know what? I got to pull that darn thing up here. I got two things to do here. But anyways, we like to just say, well, I try to multitask, that we've got, this is, of course, the time of giving. And it's we've raised about half of the money now needed to run the radio station here. So again, to make this very easy for all of us, again, we ask that you please put in a monthly donation on behalf of Inside the Eye Live. Again, we'd like to just at least cover Inside the Eye Live. We're looking to bring in really about 100 people that are able to afford $3 to $4 a week. That would be $300 to $400 a month. That would cover our portion for sure of what is happening here. Mind you, Inside the Eye Live is not like a lot of these other shows. This is it's a premium show. It brings in a lot of listeners. You guys know you're logging on, you're coming in, you're listening, and you're going home. You understand that. We get it too. Trust us. We know what's happening here. There's a lot of shows here. You know, we're trying to run a 24/7 type of radio station. We've got two studios, largely filled now, not entirely, but largely filled. Studio A is pretty much 100% filled, and Studio B is rapidly filling up with an addition of a lot of hosts. So, but this show is one of the premium shows here. So what we ask you really to do is put together some type of donation, just for, again, Inside the Eye Live. And if you do that, we're happy, station's happy, and that means all the other guests, they got to do their part equally. We're one of the shows that chew up a lot of bandwidth. We chew up a lot of resources. For this show, extra effort is made now to, again, take care of you, the customer, the listener. And so we know the telephone lines are open. Again, 1-323-275-1314. How'd you like the way I just kind of set that in there? So, guys, again, do what you can to, you know, basically just cover everything, because we need your support. And without your support, it makes it very, very difficult to literally run our shows, because we just don't have the technology to support the infrastructure and everything else needed here. So, again, just do your part to help us run our show, run our network. We want to be doing a live show. We appreciate the chance to do a live show. And again, so we like it. Again, so we like it. We appreciate your support immensely. And again, we ask that you continue to support freedomslips.com. Starting the first of the year, we're going to have the websites are rapidly getting rolled out, a whole new look, fresh new look. And so, again, just do what you can. We're not asking for too much. You guys know the game here. We're not George Soros. We don't have billions of dollars supporting us. And so please, again, get the word out, and yourself, get your wallet out. Help support freedomslips.com, at least for this part of the show. Now, of course, this show has been sponsored for quite some time. It is the Catch Report, and it's proudly sponsored by North Kakalaki Trading Posts, good services and solutions for all things great and small. It's inconveniently located at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk. And by Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club, a radio show hosted by Blackbird Nine, a.k.a. Frederick C. Blackburn. Frederick is an NSA whistleblower, 9/11 truth advocate, former 32-degree Mason, and a former North Carolina House candidate. And you can hear Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club every Wednesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. on Spreaker. So for more information, be sure to visit BlackbirdNineTradingPosts.org, BlackbirdNineTradingPosts.org. The cat report this week is going to be kind of short, but it's kind of fun. It's mating season in Jordan. So One Eye, my big male, and my guy, he's one of the dominant males in the larger area where I live here in Amman, you know, within his territory. He's a big guy. He's a strong guy. He's well-fed, so he's healthy. He's not emaciated by any degree. He's a good, strong cat. But, you know, Mother Nature always brings competitors to the table, and so you're going to find that there's other cats that are strong out there equally. He's not the strongest, but I know he's one of the strongest. He is always out there when it comes time for mating season. And I know the other day he came home with blood dripping off of his ears and under his ears and around the top of his head. Apparently got into a nice, but he was out. He didn't come home. For 2 days, he was out, and when he came home this past day, yesterday, he was just dirty as you can be. And mind you, this is a beautiful, big, white cat, and he was so filthy, and he smelled bad. He didn't come home. Emily's angry with him, like, why did you stay out? Of course, she knows why. He wants sex, right? This is cat time. He's got to go get his cat sex. So he's out there. He's enjoying the time. But he stayed out all night, literally didn't come home. And the cutest thing is I called home this morning because I got to send money around for the Christmas season. So I called home to get the final orders here. And when they got out of bed, they went out to the front room. Now, what they do is my house has like a front living room, and then there's a door that seals it from the family room. And so One Eye was literally waiting at the door that separates the living room from the family room, and he's staring at the door. He's staring up at Emily, and I'm looking at it because it's all on camera. And then he starts talking to her, you know, meow, 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 and he starts talking to her, like, open the door now. I need to go outside. Open the door. Open the door. And she said, no, you eat first. Then you can go outside and go chase the girls. So she fed him, had a quick breakfast. Nice chicken liver. He loves his chicken liver. And so he went back to the door, and then he starts, hey, open the door now. Open the door. Meow, meow, meow. So they open the door, and they tease him. They actually have fun with him because they know exactly what he wants. They just kind of tease him and draw it out a little bit for drama. So then he gets through that door, and then he's got to deal with the front door. It's locked, and he's looking at the door, and then he looks up at the camera, and Emily looks at the door, looks back up. He's like, hey, would you open the door already? Come on. I want to get out. So he finally was allowed to go outside today. And he went down to the street level. It's just a flight of about 10 to 12 stairs. It's a gradual slope, but about 10 to 12 stairs. He gets to the street, and the first thing he does is he just starts screaming out, hey, to the girls, hey, I'm here. I'm here. Some of the strangest meows and screeches that I've heard in a while. And he's just talking up a storm, literally telling the girls, I'm outside, everybody. Come follow me. Now, Emily saw him the other day chasing a couple girl cats, at least one girl cat. So he is now busy doing his Mother Nature procreation thing, and he's having a great time, I'm sure. He loves to fight, quite frankly. He likes to fight. He's a big guy. He can afford it, I guess. So that's it. You know, it's mating season. We've had a couple fights around here, not too many, but it's men mating season there. And that kind of is it. It's crazy at the house. There's a lot of cat fights, a lot of screaming, a lot of open the door for me right now. You're taking too long. But if you've ever seen that, it's kind of actually kind of cute to watch and to witness. So he's I don't even think he's even home yet. I haven't called home yet since this morning, but I don't think he's even home. He is out once again chasing the girls. That's right. the story is One Eye is chasing after all the girl cats. So that is the Cat Report again. It's proudly sponsored by North Kakalaki Trading Post. Good services and solutions for all things great and small. Again, inconveniently located at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk and by Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club, a radio show hosted by Blackbird Nine, a.k.a. Frederick C. Blackburn. And for more information, by the way, you can hear his show, Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club, every Wednesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. on Spreaker. And for more information, again, visit BlackbirdNineTradingPost.org. That's BlackbirdNineTradingPost.org, again, for more information. And now it's time for, that's right, it is time for the Oy Vey moment.
Oy Gewalt! It's like another shower!
Oy Vey!
Oy Vey!
Oy Vey, everybody!
Hollywood is run by Jews. It's owned by Jews. Very goddamn angry at some of the Jews.
I thrive on William Peers.
Oy Vey!
Oy Vey, everybody!
This Oy Vey moment is brought to you by Radio Werewolf and HeartlandOnline.net. Radio Werewolf is now streaming 24 hours of no-nonsense, uncensored radio centered around the pro-European Western civilization spirit. And be sure to catch all their live shows at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. To listen live or catch the archived shows and curated content, visit werewolfradio.com. That's W-E-H-R, wolfradio.com. And if you want to expand your information options and find like-minded content, visit heartlandonline.net, where you will find many popular and insightful Western-centric podcasts, news articles, videos, music, and much more, including yours truly, The Fetch, and Inside the Eye Live. So just remember, Radio Werewolf, that's W-E-H-R Wolf, and heartlandonline.net. And this week's Oy Vey moment is coming to us out of Los Angeles, that bastion of Jewish supremacy. And it is over a song, not really a song, but as a concert by a Iranian Muslim singer. And they never put his name or something. Actually, this is written in. The story comes to us from the Jewish Journal. I've actually read that a lot while I was in Los Angeles. What a racist, bigoted article the Jewish Journal is, to use Jewish language. It's basically filled with a lot of Jewish supremacy and Jewish bigotry. And, of course, this article just kind of highlights that. But they're saying here that the singer's name, Mohsen Yegena, and again, inside of Los Angeles, what a lot of people don't know is a lot of the Iranians inside of Los Angeles are Jews. People don't really know that. But a lot of the Iranians in LA are very close to the Jewish community or are themselves Jewish. So when you hear Iranians, 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 hello again. You're dealing largely not with Iranians. You're dealing with Jews. Now, that's not true of all of them, of course. Be pragmatic, but understand the reality. When you deal in LA, Los Angeles, a lot of the Iranians there are either closely linked to the Jewish community or are themselves Jews themselves. So you got to take everything with a grain of salt when you hear the U.S. media talk about Jews or Iranians in America. They're not Iranians. They're Jews first. Now, in this case, Mr. Mohsen Yegena, he is being accused of using anti-Semitic and anti-Israel lyrics in a song. That's right. He's been accused of saying something that these Jews consider anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. And at some point, where do we start to draw the line of Jews imposing their own form of censorship upon the rest of the community? Where do we start to attack Jews themselves for calling for attacks against everybody else? It says here, our community is now recognizing that this great country, and this is quoted from, again, the Jewish Journal, Our community is now recognizing that in this great country, while bigots are free to express bigotry, we are also free to shout down their hate, shame them, and hurt them in their pocketbooks, said Sam Yebri, president of 30 Years After, a local Iranian Jewish nonprofit group. Do Jews even work for a living? I swear, do they work for a living or they just collect NGO money, which is taxpayer funded because it's all tax deductible income or tax deductible donations, and then use that money to impose themselves onto the rest of us? Do these lowlifes even work for a living? Now, again, Mr. Sam Yebri supports Israel, so we should assume he is, quote unquote, a bigot himself. Mr. Yebri supports Israel. We should assume he is a Jewish supremacist himself. Mr. Yebri, Sam Yebri, supports Israel. So we should assume he is, again, a vile, anti-human, racist piece of you-know-what. And when you start to take this Star Chamber logic, the Star Chamber vindictiveness, and hurt them in the pocketbook, at what point are we now saying, look, don't call me anti-Semite, you little whatever you want to call them. We have every right to hurt you in the pocketbook, and we have every right to start to take away your freedoms to make a living for believing in what you believe in. Because that's what we're starting to deal with here. If you believe in something that you don't, or that does not fit into the Jewish model, Jews and their social justice warrior, vindictive clowns in many cases, believe they have a right to do whatever they want to you. At what point are we going to say enough is a community and start hitting back? Now, according to this here, LA's Mr. Mohsen Yegana is due to sing at an upcoming concert at downtown's LA's Microsoft Theater. I don't even know where that is, quite frankly. Now, some of the organizations that are calling for a boycott are Sinai Temple. Well, why is Sinai Temple involving itself in political affairs? Why don't we take away its nonprofit status here? Go after. In other words, we have to start to really focus in and hone in on how Jewish money is being funneled to impose its will upon the rest of us. Another synagogue, Nessa Synagogue, and then the Hebrew Discovery Center, which is a Jewish Iranian, it's a Jewish organization based in Reseda that created an online petition demanding that the concert be canceled, and it generated more than 4,000 signatures. Now, if you can imagine, folks, 4,000 signatures, how tightly knit people say, it's not all Jews, it's not all Jews. Well, where do you think those 4,000 signatures are coming from? You don't think that they're not working in unison as a aggregate group to create 4,000 signatures? I'll tell you what, all of you, today, tomorrow, you go out and you try to do something and go get signatures. Try it. Try it without an organized backing. Try it without having groups working with you in cohesion or in collusion with you. Go try to collect 4,000 signatures. I can't even do it, and I have a reasonably listened-to radio station, but I can't do it. Heck, I just can't. I try. I can't. No way. Now, as Jews, as he says here, as Jews living in Iran for hundreds of years, we did not have a voice or a right to speak out when anyone in this country spoke bad about us. Oh, well, whine, you little loser. That is Rabbi Nathaniel Louie. He said, now that we have a voice and a right in this country, we must speak out and make people aware of this hate generated against our people. Well, you know what? It is now time for you to start making Jews know that you are against the hate that they give to you. Every menorah out there is a symbol of Jewish hate. It is not a Jewish Christmas. It is a symbol of Jewish victory over their host nations. It is nothing less than a symbol of Jewish hate. When do you start shouting down Jewish hate? Every time you see this menorah. When you see the menorah you put out there, take this hate down. Take this hate down. Now, local Iranian Jewish activists argue that the reference to the two triangles refers to the Star of David, and that the vultures of the song's title refers to Jews. So, in other words, the guy's actually speaking. Here's the guy. The guy's speaking in coded language. He talks about the two triangles. He talks about the vultures. And they're saying, well, they're talking about us Jews. But that was never explicitly stated by the singer. It was never explicitly stated by the singer. So, you know where we come from? when you start to defend yourself against coded language, you're basically outing yourself as being guilty. So you know what? We should look at the Jewish community and those backing this boycott, again, is that you are vultures and you are evil. Very simple. Because otherwise, why are you reacting to it? I can't imagine reacting to it. It wouldn't have anything to do with me because I'm not any one of those two. And of course, the hyperbole and the drama that they talk about, we are radiant Jews. Say it loud and clear terms that we will not stand for attacks to our dignity. Oh, really? What are you going to do about it in the long term, dudes? Really, an attack to your dignity, yet you will throw pedophilia in our face. You will throw transgender agendas in our face. You will throw mass immigration in our face. You will throw all kinds of things that assault our dignity, yet you think we're not supposed to do anything. Yet this is your attitude about a singer, and it's just basically two lyrics in a song you don't like. And you're going to go through all this drama because you find it, quote unquote, anti-Semitic. There is a former board member of the Iranian Nessa Synagogue in Beverly Hills. His name is George Harunian. He says, we know and understand Iranian culture and the political scene. Calling Israel and Jews a flock of vultures is pure and simple anti-Semitism. No, we call it simile, dude. Yeah, why are you calling simile anti-Semitism? It's simile. You're a flock of vultures. You prey on the dead. You create societies that decay from inside, and then you prey on the carcass. We could call you a parasite, if you prefer, because that's kind of what you're telling us here. Various ADL local and national affiliates got involved. You got to love the ADL. They went on to Twitter condemning the video's content and the song. Likewise, the quote-unquote the Creative Community for Peace that never ends with Jewish organization here, an entertainment industry organization based in New York, a Jewish organization based in New York, folks. They fight cultural boycotts of Israel. Okay, yeah, you're Jewish. And they released a statement on social media platforms condemning Yagana's upcoming L.A. performance because of, quote-unquote, an anti-Israeli song. Since when do Jews have a right to tell people coming to America that we cannot be anti-Israel? Do you realize 50% of Americans do not believe the official story that Jews sold us regarding 9/11? That means the majority of Americans don't buy Jewish BS, and there's no reason for us who understand this to remain silent. Those 50% support us. We are in the majority, everybody. Nobody buys Jewish BS here. Nobody's buying it. Don't allow all it. In fact, every time we see these Oy Vey moments come up, we should use it as an advantage to us to hit, strike, and attack back. Do not ever allow this, to use their terms here, race or culture of vultures to prevail in having a voice. That is the Oy Vey moment, everybody. Again, it is brought to us by Radio Werewolf and HeartlandOnline.net. You can find the story at the Jewish Journal, and one way you can equally find more is just put Iranian singer anti-Semitic. Just plug that into Google or to DuckDuckGo as I do, and you will again be able to find that article and many others like it, I'm sure. And so one last thing I want to talk about. You know, we notice here in this particular story, all these Jews talking. It's all Jewish. Of course, it's the Jewish Journal, but it's all Jewish. We had an incident recently about, you know, on Twitter, and you hear it a lot out there. It's like, all you do is blame Jews. All you do is blame Jews. Well, when I see incidents like this, who am I supposed to talk about, everybody? Is it the Chinese who are trying to throttle back our freedom of expression? Is it it's the Jewish people, guys? Why is it that Jews do not want to take responsibility for their actions and then blame us for noticing? It's the Fetch Inside the Eye, live intelligent media for the politically aware. Back with more right after this. All right, everybody, welcome back. It is the Fetch Inside the Eye, live intelligent media for the politically aware, right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And as I try to multitask here again, go quicker, dude, go quicker. It's a fun Saturday afternoon now for some of you. Joining us from North Kakalaki, it is indeed the sponsor of the Cocktail Cat Report. And that would be Frederick C. Blackburn, also known as BB9, Blackbird 9, among a couple other, I think, nicknames out there. Frederick, welcome to Inside the Eye Live.
Well, good morning, good evening, Merry Christmas, and Happy Solstice.
Yeah, you know, it's going to be what? This coming week, we're going to hit the solstice again, which is kind of a great thing. Hey, welcome back.
Ah, great to be back. Always a pleasure, good sir.
Yeah, you know, it's great to have you. We tried to bring you on for Inside the Eye Live Primetime to talk about Hanukkah, which was started.
I apologize that that wouldn't work. I still don't know why we couldn't connect. No,
it's purely a codec mismatches between me, you, the studio, and the codecs required to allow us to be able to hear the bumper music. So if we don't have certain codecs set in a certain way, we can't hear the bumper music playing through and know when the breaks are starting, ending, et cetera. But when we enable these codecs in a certain way, it prevents you from actually joining the call. It's an actual Skype issue. It's 100% debugged now. It's 100% Skype. They changed the whole codec design, and because of that, we can no longer do things unless we manually set the server. So nothing on your side.
Ah, okay. So it's the, as we used to say back before I got blacklisted, it's in the signaling of, you know, wondering if they're using the old H225 or SIP on Skype these days.
Yeah, exactly. It's something to do with the auto. Whenever you use Skype, everybody, when you make a call and you have music going in the background, Skype automatically reduces the background music. So it doesn't allow you to hear the background music come through. So when they automatically reduce that, it removes it from the conversation when I hear it on this side. And so it's just a nightmare. It's a headache. We're still trying to debug it and resolve it, and we're still not done.
I feel, because over at the Trading Post for the Breakfast Club, we've paid for a Skype dial-in number for a year, and it worked for a week, and then it would not work anymore. And I have spent hours with Skype trying to get it resolved. And finally, we just, when it came for renewal, we didn't renew it.
I've actually got an open trouble ticket with Skype to try to solve it. Literally, they called me and we've been working with them, but it is in the codec. I mean, they screwed up the codec when they did something, and now they have to actually go recode the whole freaking Skype. Everybody, if you're not familiar with Blackbird 9, he's the guy here. Frederick's got his own show. It's called Blackbird 9 Trading Post. Again, he's the sponsor of the ITIL Cat Report. He's been sponsoring. How long have you been sponsoring this darn segment now? How long?
I guess 2 years now, because that's when the show started.
Yeah, you've been going 2 years now. I mean, thank you so much for that. You know, it's been great to have you. I know. How's your show doing now?
The show's doing really well. You know, that you always have that learning curve of first trying to get the technical stuff worked out. It's like getting the website set up, getting, you know, like Spreaker set up or however you're going to go out, and all of the technical problems that were associated with that. And then trying to, like with anything, trying to find your identity out there. It's just, you know, well, what is this show going to be? And so we've really kind of chipped off the rough edges that first year, and we've had really great mentors. Again, thank you so much for all you did to help us. Also the crew over at Radio Werewolf, Cy Garden, Mr. Dion, and also the crew over at Renegade, the crew over at Hooley's, the crew over at Mamie's. You know, everybody has just been wonderful helping us. Every time we'd have something we didn't even know what it was, much less how to fix it, you know, we'd call one of y'all and you go, oh yeah, I went through that back in this, and this is what you do. And so I just thank you again for all that cooperative game theory there.
You know, in some respects, I'm beginning to see our loose network, which is, I think you've got a I forget what you call it, and you can give me and everybody else the name, but open source collaboration, I think you call it, something like that.
Yeah, well, I always tell people, you know, all my stuff is open source shareware. And all my work is based on, instead of a centralized master-slave model, which is systems like Judaism are based on, my system is based on distributed peer-to-peer game theory and cooperative game theory versus non-cooperative game theory. You know, the Jews are all about that master intransigence, the offer you can't refuse, you know, forcing you into a check situation to force you then into a checkmate situation. That's all non-cooperative game theory. With cooperative game theory, it's a completely different type of worldview. And instead of trying to force people to do something, you're saying, well, this will be mutually beneficial to everybody involved. And the other thing that's interesting about the way we're doing things is with cooperative game theory, you get the added benefit of synergy, which is basically an engineering concept of the sum is greater than, I mean, the total is greater than the sum of its parts. You just kind of get this added benefit when people cooperate that is more than the individuals working alone, if you think of it that way. And also just the synchronicity that when you start using cooperative game theory, you just really start seeing a lot of synchronicity, those meaningful coincidences, and you follow those. And it's interesting the way that, you know, things just seem to solutions present themselves, if that makes any sense. And the other thing about cooperative game theory is it's not a zero sum game. It's infinite game theory versus Judaism and those kind of systems are all, you know, zero sum games where a Jew thinks if they can steal from you $10, then their side has a net gain over your side. And it's like this, you know, finite bounded game. Well, what we're playing is a completely different type of game where it's infinite. You know, it's a boundless game. And so you get more, like I said, than the sum of the parts. It's not a zero sum game. So that, you know, this is, I think, key as to how we're going to fight this new type of warfare, this, you know, what we call it fourth generation, fifth generation asymmetrical warfare. And so it's just, you know, these are the kind of tools that we're using to wake up and level up people, as we say at the Breakfast Club.
Now, you obviously, for people that don't know you, of course, they should by now listening to this show, but you spent years within the Freemasonic systems. I believe you're Blue Lodge, not Scottish. That's correct.
Well, everybody goes through the Blue Lodge. Blue Lodge refers to your first 3 degrees, and that's your Entered Apprentice, your Fellowcraft, and your Master Mason. So those are considered your Blue Lodge degrees. And then you have two paths. You can either go Scottish Rite or York Rite. And the way it was explained to me back in the 80s when I was doing this, and of course, remember, I haven't been affiliated with the Freemasons since the late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. But to be at the next level, which is called the Shriners, everybody knows about the Shriners, wear the fez hats and drive the little go-karts and the parades, et cetera, and supposedly do all these good works for children, hospitals, et cetera. But to be a Shriner, you had to be 32nd degree or equivalent, which is a 32nd degree Mason, to be a Shriner. And so you can either fulfill that requirement with the Scottish Rite, which is the 32 degrees, or the York Rite, which is set up in three sections. And even though it's not 32 degrees like the Scottish Rite, you know, Albert Pike's Scottish Rite, the York Rite is considered the 32nd degree equivalent. So once you've completed the York Rite, then you can join the Shriners. You know, at that, by the time I got through the York Rite and everything, owing to changes in my life and direction, et cetera, I left the Masons without ever pursuing the Shriners. But that was the original goal, because like I always say in the interviews, you know, here in North Carolina, that was just one of those things you did. You went to Boy Scouts, you got your Eagle Scout, you go to college, you come back and you join civic groups. And one of those civic groups is the Freemasons. And everybody, you know, all the business leaders and stuff were, when I was growing up, were all Freemasons. And I just thought that was just part of one of those rites of passage of community service, et cetera. And then you find out that there's a lot more involved with the Freemasons than just good deeds, so to speak. And you find out.
Yeah, you've slowly been winning me over, by the way, because with your presentation. I'm a tough guy to break, you know, when I have my beliefs. But you slowly, not entirely, but I've got to admit, not entirely. But you've slowly been winning your way. You've slowly been winning. How do I turn that? You've been slowly been winning me over to your views on what happened here in the creation of Freemasonry. I've always seen it as a sect in its original creation that was designed to counter this top-down stuff, to create, as you would say, this open-source game theory here. And obviously it quickly got corrupted, but I've always believed that it was something that was designed to preserve a lot of information that otherwise would have been drowned.
And I always concede that point. It's that, you know, holding on to those old systems of esoteric knowledge and preserving them in symbol, which I find is very valuable. And the system, that's what I always stress in my shows, is the system for when it was designed is an incredibly beautiful static system for small scale. And one of my hypotheses is that this system was actually designed in what we would consider prehistory, meaning from about 10,000 BC to about 4,000 BC, that when you were getting those original city-states like Jericho, that these type of systems that the Freemasons and the Knights Templars, when you look at their design, you see that they were probably designed during that period for a centralized power system. And so when you look at it like that, it's like looking at the phone system and saying, wow, what a great design. Yeah, for when this was put in place, this was fantastic. But when you try to scale this system to a global design, it doesn't work. You know, the centralized master-slave systems don't scale well. And then you find out that the Jews have basically gone in and corrupted Freemasonry to be part of their world Zionist agenda. And when we find, and we'll talk about this when we talk about, you know, the menorah and Hanukkah and all this, but, you know, part of that design is the destruction of Western civilization, you know, white people. And I think this is part of the symbolism of the third degree, where you have the murder of Hiram Abiff and the Gentile candidate that's going for his Master Mason degree plays the part of Hiram Abiff, the only non-Jew in that passion play, and he gets murdered right as the temple is being completed. So basically, you brought in this Gentile to build this thing, and then he was killed. And so when you look at Freemasonry as the worker bees that are going to build this Jewish New World Order of Pax Judaica, and they don't realize that as part of that, once they get this in place, there's no place in that New World Order for them and their families and their kind. And that's what we see in things
like their organization. And let's be honest, there's a lot of great people in these organizations that do a lot of good work.
Yes. That
also goes by the wayside.
And also, you know, you look at the U.S. history of how we moved from a colony of the Crown / the City of London Central Banks in our revolution, that, you know, so many people had learned this Freemason model, and from that you had that spark of genius that became the Articles of, you know, first the Declaration of Independence, then the Articles of Confederacy, then the U.S. Constitution, and that way that this republic was created. There was just a certain genius there. And I don't think they could have gone to that next level if it hadn't have been for systems like Freemasonry, much the same way as we could have never had the internet if we hadn't had the telephone system and the telegraph system first, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I have a beef with you on one thing.
Okay, let me have it.
I got a beef with you. I was listening to your show with Graham Hart, found it very fascinating. But if you can, to set this up, and it's a fun beef, by the way, you know us.
I agree with myself all the time.
I didn't agree with you entirely, man. And you were like kind of like praising me right afterwards. And it's like, I think he must realize he made a mistake there and he's going to like be nice to me. So I'm nice to him in return. And that has to do with copper. Can you describe for the audience why cops and copper are so important and why they are linked together going back to the Egyptian era?
Okay. When you look at the early development of calendar systems, you first see that so many calendar systems are based on sevens. Okay, that's some reason, you know, we had all of this calendar system, and the calendars go back to the last great ice age. I mean, when you look at the Venus Lavoux or whatever calendar, that's 30,000 BC or some such like that, which is a lunar calendar, 28 days, 4 weeks of 7 days each. And of course, this, you know, ties into that lunar cycle, but also the female Homo sapien menstrual cycle, which is linked with that lunar cycle. But this laid the foundation.
Isn't the cycle also called to men the headache cycle?
The headache cycle, exactly.
Sorry, ladies, I'm just teasing. Come on.
Why men really became hunters and gatherers, right?
It's time to go hunting, guys.
I'll be back in
a day. We'll be back in about 5 days, ladies. We got to go find some food.
But anyway, so you had the seven cycles, and one of the things that we learn is that in the early days of astronomy, and that then gave way to astrology, there were considered seven great free-willed planets, because one of the things these early astronomers and astrologers discovered, that all the stars seem to rotate around a pole star that we call now Polaris. And this time it was actually part of the Draco system because of the shift, but, you know, that complicates things. But, you know, just think of that you have a circumpolar system. All the stars move orderly fashion, stay together, with the exception of seven celestial objects. And those are the Moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, or as it was known as Lucifer, then Saturn, and then the Sun. So these are the seven free-willed planets of the ancient systems, the ancient calendar systems. And the way they organized those was in that order. It was first the Moon. What is the phase of the Moon? Because all of these early cycles, it's like, you know, the new moon, first quarter, then, you know, the full moon, and then last quarter, and then you have a new moon again. And so that was your moon day or Monday, and then the week was arranged so that, you know, the Sunday was the seventh day. Okay, now the fifth day, so you got that five, is that Venus and Lucifer. And so when we started developing metal technologies around 6,000 to 4,000 BC, the element of copper became associated with that fifth day. And the symbol is that circle with the plus sign under it, or it's a key. Okay, so that circle with the plus sign is a key. And the part of the culture that got associated with that was basically your enforcers, your beta club. I always call them beta club, beta coppers and beta thug coppers, because they were basically your muscle. And so these were the people that would, in the early days of prisons, and, you know, once you develop iron metal technologies, one of the first things you had was metal cages and metal chains. And so that Friday became associated with, you know, Venus, copper, and this idea of the five-pointed star of authority that served the sixth day, which was basically your Saturn, that is where they would bring you for judgment. And so these systems, basically you had, and I'm painting with a very broad brush here, so don't get irritated with me if I get a nuance wrong, but you know, so basically your agrarian work day was, you know, if you finished all your chores on Thursday, you know, that Jove, that Jupiter, you got to go to the temple early, whatever. Friday, you know, that's when you had to start accounting for why your job wasn't done. And if you did something wrong, you would then be brought before the sixth day people, you know, as to what your sentence would be, if that makes sense. And then seventh was that day of rest. And then on Monday, everything started over again. And so when you start looking at that, you know, copper, and also one of the strange things when looking at the way Venus moves through the heavens from Earth in what we call a geocentric model, is that over a four-year period, it makes a five-pointed star. If you track Venus or Lucifer's pattern over 4 years, it makes a five-pointed star. Then it disappears behind the sun and reemerges on the other side to make a five-pointed star, a pentagram, inverted. So the point is down, and then it repeats. And so you get that lambiscate pattern of that infinity symbol of 4 years and 4 years, or an 8 year cycle. And we see this echoed through with the 4 year games of the Olympics, because in these lunar calendars, there was a little bit of a shift. And what they would do is every 4 years put those missing 5 days back into the calendar and start over. And that was the correcting years, if you will, for the calendars. And so that's where those copper symbols and all come in for Friday. And the idea.
But you mentioned like the copper and the cops. Well, we go already. Good segment there. It's the Fetch with Frederick C. Blackburn, everybody. Blackburn Nine's Breakfast Club. More right up. Everybody, welcome back. It's the Fetch, Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware, right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Joining us from North Cackalacky, North Carolina, the host of Blackbird Nine's Trading Post. Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. And, of course, the sponsor of the ITEL Cat Report, which is, gosh, I get them so crazy. Sorry about this, man. Blackbird Nine's Trading Post. And you got kind of confused me there, Frederick, but welcome back.
Great. And, oh, I forgot to mention Happy Yule in there. So
yeah, Yule
happy
too.
Yule to everyone.
Now, here's where we start to get to the beef. You're equating copper with the five-pointed star, right?
Correct.
And copper with the five-pointed star is then equated to Venus.
Correct.
And then you're saying that the symbol of Venus is the key to let you out. Remember you talked about the key of Venus?
Symbol, you know, the keys. Right. And it's also a feminine symbol.
It's a feminine. Here's where I had the beef then. Okay. Maybe you're right, but I think the key here for Venus is this. And I'm not saying I'm right, because, you know, it's hard. We're just it's all conjecture, as they say at the end of the day. You know how that works.
Everything we know, we have experiential data of what we have learned, you know, what we saw, experienced in our own life, and everything else is hearsay.
Yes. Now, what I think Venus is and Mars is I think Venus, first go to Mars. What's Cupid's arrow is, of course, this love, about love between the men and the women, right? Cupid's arrow. So, of course, if you're hit with Cupid's arrow, you're hit with love and all that fun stuff. What I honestly think Venus and Mars is all about is Mars is the spermatoa leaving the male as a spear or an arrow, and then entering the female becomes the Venus. And then that's the, basically what you're seeing is half of a dimension between a spear going from the male to the female. One, you see the spear exit. The other, you see the sphere enter.
Okay. Now, with take that and put it back in those, what I call the copper era, or in my Breakfast Club model, we talk about T3, the copper era, which is from 10,000 BC to about 4,000 BC. And these systems were all matriarchal. These systems were fertility cults. And this is when we were developing husbandry and domestication of animals. And you started seeing things like castration of animals and selective breeding as the would realize that these animals, when you put them in contained areas, the males will get along better if you pick the lesser choices and castrate them. And then the steers won't fight with the bulls, and the bulls will tolerate the steers kind of systems. But also this competitiveness of who is going to go to the temple and who's going to be the sun king of the year. And these were very competitive systems with the men basically out farming and doing the livestock raising, et cetera, and the women in the temple areas of the city state, the central areas, doing things like the accounting and the rationing at schedule of these, you know, beginning civilizations. So I love your symbolism there of, yes, that person, that man who's sent out on Tuesday to do the chores of the week, and if he gets everything done by Friday, he gets to go to the temple that night and, you know, have all that he can eat, have all he can drink, and, you know, have his pick of the temple maidens or whatever. So what do you think of that?
That kind of adds into supporting some of the creation of society to match the symbols, because I know they crafted around the symbols quite often. And here's another one.
Okay.
Under the same vein, because when you look at the birth of the five gods, you know, between Osiris, Isis, Seth, Nephthys, and Horus, Seth is born not in the normal way, but he comes as through the side of his mother. Okay? That's like the spear coming out, and that becomes then Seth is the god of war or Mars. To link the symbols to Christianity, at the death of Jesus, they say that the spear pierced his side.
Mm-hmm.
And then therefore now they're going to feminize Jesus into like a Mary figure. And they're going to start to morph Jesus into the feminine figure of Isis, linked, of course, to Mary, because you can't do it all in one shot, if you know what I mean. You're going to have to like morph it and create. You're going to have to morph the symbols together as you create these new movements. So I equate then the being born out of the side of the mother as, of course, and we always use side for death. If you notice, suicide, infanticide. We link that side, you know, Seth being born out of the side of his mother with death, the god of war, and then piercing Jesus with the spear, and blood and water came out, the birth cycle, the Venus cycle, as being actually two achromatic ciphers over time and space to talk about two different symbols, one Venus, one Mars. What do you think of that one?
Wow, that's some great symbolism. Yeah, bringing these ancient symbols in, and that's, I guess, one of the fascinating things in my research is seeing how a symbol can come to mean different things. Sometimes they build on previous knowledge, and sometimes it's a completely different meaning or a new meaning that has been imposed on the symbol as you move through these different epochs of history since the last great ice age, especially.
Well, and one of the greatest is the term Lucifer, quite frankly. It has come to become quite demonic, satanic, etc. But it comes from Luxor, which was in the hometown of Osiris himself.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen a morphing of like Luxor and Lucifer and Venus, and all these links has been completely destroyed, quite frankly, compared to its original meanings. That's as I view it.
Right. And one of the adages there is the virtues of one age are the vices of the next age. Because once you had that power shift, suddenly everything that used to be the normal is now taboo.
And we're entering that realm again. But that's what, to me, like the Freemasons were always originally about, preserving that information before it could completely destroyed. Last issue before we set things up, I want to go back now to the story or the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Oh, wow.
You're familiar with the Epic of Gilgamesh, correct?
Yes.
Now, the person who saves humanity is Gilgamesh himself. Okay? Now, I read an article or a story or a book from like 1869, 1870, something like this, and they were talking about Gilgamesh in the article, and I wish I would have recorded, but I don't, but just trust that I'm telling the truth here. The story says something like, look at the story of Gilgamesh. The name Gilgamesh himself is not really Sumerian. It is a cleverly crafted word to hide its significance, and it's cleverly enough to establish to determine what we mean by it. And they never talked about what they were talking about. And what I believe Gilgamesh is, because it's crafted, it's a crafted word, is you simply reverse it. E is E, M-A, if you look at it backwards, M-A is an N, and then G-L-I from Gilgamesh becomes, and then you hop the S-H back, and Gilgamesh is actually a code for English. What I believe is happening here, Frederick, is that when you look at the story of the Epic of Gilgamesh, there was supposed to be a planned destruction of humanity under this quote-unquote a deluge of mankind, you know, the immersing them in water, which you can take literally, I say, the delusion, false beliefs, false ideas, everything about it is just false, is delusion. That is what was planned for humanity. But somebody, like within English, kept it alive, kept the spark alive. And from Western civilization, we had this massive contribution to mankind, which really raised it up. If you look at Japan, it had basically come to its epic under the samurai system. And in order for Japan to grow, they were going to have to crash the samurai system and adopt parts of the West. Otherwise, it would not technologically advance any further. Same with the Chinese. A lot of very rich cultures could never really raise themselves up without the Western influence with manufacturing, technology, our ideas, etc. Is this something you would agree with?
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay, so my idea is this. On an epic global scale, what we in the West brought was that spark that could raise humankind up. Now it's spread so far, you can't stop it. The Japanese have now advanced way beyond the Chinese and other races. They've advanced pretty far now, but not so many, not so much in Africa, in other words, not so much in Southeast Asia. India, yes, some, but not really. It's still, when we look at technology on a global scale, it's not all that many races here. The Japanese, the Koreans, the Chinese, Western Europe, but you're not going to get Africa in that. You can't put Africa, you can't really put Latin America in that. Agree or disagree?
America would fall in that category as well. They haven't really adopted.
Yes, they've never really raised up their level. So here's what I think is happening. We're looking at another global Epic of Gilgamesh story where this sessionist Jewish god is seeking to submerge mankind into another sea of darkness. And the one thing that is preventing that is Gilgamesh as a code for English and all the technology that spread through English. And this is what is behind the esoteric, the macro esoteric transdimensional idea of destroying Western man. Because we preserved as a Western civilization the greatness of what could be within the human race.
That's very interesting, especially in light of, and this is just what came to mind while you were talking, the Jews, these modern Maccabees that are trying to push for this Pax Judaica and this idea of the order out of chaos, as they call their method, where they create, you know, problem, reaction, solution. They create the problems so they can offer the solutions that are in line with their agenda. That they call themselves Noahidists, because part of this system of Pax Judaica is to impose a global set of laws, a two-tiered system where there's one set of laws, the Talmud for the Jews, and then the Noahide, seven laws of Noahide for everyone else, you know, the Gentiles. This is the seven Noahide laws, and that is the master-slave system. So you have this idea of the Noahides. And when you go back to the story of Noah and you look at things like Bishop Usher's calculations of when he would place Noah in the timeline, and when we have the archaeological data around these floods in this area, you see that Usher puts Noah at about 2948 BC. And then Gilgamesh, a lot of scholars say that if Gilgamesh lived, it would place him around 2600 BC. And the tablets on which the tale of his death are preserved all date to about 1800 BC. So as far back as 1800 BC, we had that story of Gilgamesh established, and that it was around 2600 when this transition happened. And the other thing that's interesting is that also around 3000 BC is when that pentagram starts appearing in the earliest of Mesopotamian cuneiform writing, or pre-cuneiform, in 3000 BC. And then down in Egypt, in the same time, they're writing the Book of the Dead is being established. So you write in that in this period, you've got all this transition happening in this these societies all around this geographic area. So what I always look for is, you know, what happened to cause this shift? You know, there's usually something changed. And, you know, so many times you find that it's a volcano blew, or asteroid or comet hits the planet, and this chart causes widespread climate change conditions, resulting in famine, which results in people moving, people warring. It's also during this time that you start seeing the first city states being established. And so, you know, that just really pulls in with that situation of, you know, Gilgamesh, that spark that comes in and saves during this time of crisis. Here it's the flood. So, you know, was it when the Straits of Gibraltar broke through and formed the Mediterranean Ocean? You know, was there a civilization in that basin that we now see as the Mediterranean? You know, we see in the archaeological record that, you know, these coastlines have been very dynamic since the last great ice age. And so you'd have these civilizations built up along coastlines or in river or mountain valleys that would later be flooded, and those civilizations be completely forgotten about. And the people that survived would have to go someplace else and try to hang on to their history and their folk tales and their symbolisms.
When we look at our history, Frederick, obviously it's been corrupted and rewritten in such a way that it's almost fairy tale for the large part, in my opinion. Often I hear Freemasons, when you read some of the Freemasonic work, they said, you know, modern history does not take into account the history that we know of. You look at the Vimanas, the Vedas. Is it of your opinion that mankind, the human race, actually indeed fall from a much higher state?
Oh, I guess for even when I was in primary school, learning about the Great Ice Age, because that was one of the things in history they used to teach you about, the Great Ice Age and what that meant. I've always wondered, when Neanderthal and Homo sapien went into the last Great Ice Age about, 50,000 years ago, and only Homo sapien emerged, or modern man. And so you had this development of civilization starting at that end of that last Great Ice Age. But I always wonder, did Homo sapien or Neanderthal develop higher civilizations before that catastrophic event? And so did we have two threads going, so that you had one group of people that were just developing and were forced to develop Western civilization? So this was the first time all these advanced things like mathematics, et cetera, got developed. Or did we have a advanced culture before and a group of people trying to survive and preserve that culture in very rough conditions?
Mm-hmm. And beyond the monastery type of stuff, where they would preserve stuff in our monasteries across Western Europe.
Right. And you think just how bad that Ice Age was. Mm. And that we almost went extinct as a people, literally by the skin of our teeth, survived that. And you think if you were thrown into those conditions right now, how quickly everything that you know in so-called modern living would deteriorate, rot, rust, and disappear within just a few generations. So that... how would you preserve?
Just the loss of electricity now. We live on an electrical grid, electrical ocean. So just the loss of that would set everything back entirely, hundreds of years. Because without that, we cannot operate anything.
Right.
If we lost our electricity. So basically, Frederick, I don't know. I'm going to ask you, do we agree or disagree that we are basically and have been in a long-term esoteric type of battle, trans-dimensional battle of good and evil, and of which I tried to simplify it in my writing, Osiris on one side and Seth on the other, that are the tales that we are left with. And we are faced now with a battle in which Seth, this Jewish mentality, has risen upon this planet here and now is seeking to really, really put a coup de grace into the Osirian systems here.
Oh, I would agree with that 100%, that we definitely have two very different systems battling for the future of this planet, and that one system, I think, is perhaps hobbled or handicapped in the sense that it's trying to include the system that wants its destruction.
Yes, very true.
The Western civilization model is trying to include everyone, including the people that want it destroyed so it can be replaced with their system. And I go back to the Piscean Age symbols, the exoteric symbol of the two fishes. Why the two fishes representing this time period, and you think of these two battling systems. And I always tell people at the Breakfast Club, always remember that, 30 AD, you have the Passion of Jesus Christ, and the destruction, and 70 AD, you have the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem by Rome, and that war never ended.
That's a great segue into this as we start to talk about the menorah. A lot of people really stress it. Go ahead and stress it again in your own way. The war that Roman and the West waged against Jews and Judaism all the way back to 60, 70 AD, that war has never finished in the minds of the Jewish people. And add your flavor to that.
Well, that was my big aha moment with all of this was realizing that world Zionism is not new, that war with Rome never ended. That war with the Greeks never ended. That war with the Egyptians never ended. That war with the Babylonians, Persians never ended. The Jews are a master slave system, always have been, always will be, and you are either a good slave, bad slave, or they will destroy you. And it's just that master mindset that they feel that they are the masters and that everyone else is considered cattle, that Jews are just naturally superior, and that they lost Jerusalem has been their reason for existence and to get revenge. And that's what all of these Jewish holidays are about, is remembering the revenge against their enemies. You know, these are not celebrations of light and goodness and peace and harmony in humanity. These Jewish religions are all about war and revenge and subjugation of non-Jewish people. That's all Jewish holidays are about.
And when we look at the creation of Israel, just to show people how intensely motivated Jews are regarding this timeless war against really all of humanity, but especially Western Europe, when the state of Israel was corrected, leading Zionist figures walked through the Arch of Titus backwards as a symbol of saying we are now rapidly reversing our losses from that basically catastrophic time in our history.
Exactly. That is so telling about the mindset of what these Jews want. When the Arch of Titus was erected in Rome by Domitian in 81 AD to celebrate the destruction and the conquest over the Jews, Jews in Rome, and that's the other thing, is like, why were Jews allowed into Rome and into Italy? But they refused to walk under that. It was a huge taboo in Jewish culture to ever walk under the Arch of Titus, which has the, for people not familiar with it, has the image of the temple menorah, that seven candlestick menorah representing those seven free willed planets of geocentric Judaism being looted from the temple as a trophy and returned to Rome. And that symbol has become a battle cry for Jews ever since. And so, like you said, when the Israeli state was criminally founded and acknowledged by Truman after the JDL and all these other terrorist, you know, organized Jewish crime rings in the United States were sending him and his family letter bombs and everything else, and then with that carrot and stick game theory of the Jews, it's basically you can we're going to give you an offer you can't refuse, and if you will acknowledge Israel, we will give you this $2 million bribe. If you refuse, then we're going to send the hidden hand after you. And so it's on the record. You know, Truman's daughter in her book even talks about the Jewish Defense League sending letter bombs with this new chemistry explosives technology of modern chemistry. You know, that you can have a letter bomb now in the U.S. Postal Service that could kill people. That was one of the favorite tactics of these Jewish organized crime zealots.
You know, Frederick, you got time? You've never done a 2-hour show here. You got time today?
Sure.
All right. We're going to continue on with Frederick, guys. It's menorah talking time and Hanukkah, so we're setting all this up. All right, everybody, welcome back. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware, right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Joining us and has been with us for the last hour, Frederick C. Blackburn, best known here, I think, as the sponsor of the ITEL Cat Report, but he certainly has made a great name for himself also as Blackbird 9 Trading Post his private business out there, I believe. And then he's got also Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club, which is a radio show hosted by Frederick C. Blackburn, a.k.a. BB9 and a few others, Blackbird Nine. He's joined us. But before we get into that, just want to say something, because we really appreciate everything that you guys, the listener, do for us. And that is we just got just donation. I'm not calling for donations, but obviously we accept it because it helps pay the bills, everybody. And that was a Mr. Dale Y. You know your name out there. You're located in Florida. He sent $5. And guys, it all adds up. You know, our weekly, our monthly expenses, I know, are in not monthly, but annual expenses. They're probably $600-$700 a year when you break it all down. And so every little bit adds up at the end of the year. And so really, we appreciate every little bit that comes our way because it helps defer the cost to run an operation like Inside the Eye Live. Really, we invest a lot to help you, really to bring to you a really high-end quality product, as does our guest, Frederick C. Blackburn. Frederick, welcome back.
Thank you.
Isn't it great to get donations?
Oh, yes, it really does. It's at so many levels. One, you know, to be able to pay the bills, which is always a good thing. But just, you know, to log in the morning and see that, even if it's $2.
Yes, you know, it doesn't matter, man. Like, whatever you can afford, my goodness, great. You know, I've got some, you obviously have been so supportive over the years. People don't realize how much you supported in the darker days of the show, you know, when we were still trying to get ourselves established. And you did a great, came, you know, you really helped a lot in the early days. And then, but you know, you get these $50, $100 donations. It's like, ha, this is good. That'll work on my Kiwi hosting for 5 months, you know, something like that. So it's great to get those donations, everybody. So keep them coming. Of course, Blackbird, what is it? BlackbirdTradingPost.org, right? Blackbird9TradingPost.org, right? Your website?
That is correct.
Okay, well, just tell people real quickly about your show that aren't familiar. Obviously, we broadcast you every week, but just talk about your show just a little bit. What you're doing, what you've been up to.
Well, the Breakfast Club is named for a game theory model, and I wish I could take credit for it, but that was one of the terms. I never found out exactly who started using that term in game theory, but basically it describes cooperative game theory by very different people against a common adversary. And you see the same kind of game theory in next generation games like Dungeons and Dragons, Diablo, Diablo 2, World of Warcraft, where instead of competing against another player versus player type game, you're actually forming quest parties to cooperate to beat the game itself. And it's taken from a relatively obscure 1980s movie. It's not I wouldn't consider it one of the best movies ever made, but it was called The Breakfast Club, and it was one of those teenage movies of the 90s, what was called the Brat Pack at the time. And it was about a bunch of high school students from very, very different walks of life that were brought into detention. And basically, it's a study of identity politics and cooperation against a common adversary, which is the evil vice president, the authority figure in the school system itself. So that kind of became known as a Breakfast Club in game theory. And so that's why I decided to name my show, you know, The Breakfast Club. Plus, it was just funny to have in a show broadcast from 6 to 8 p.m. on Wacky Wednesdays called The Breakfast Club. You know, it's like, why do you have a show called The Breakfast Club late at night?
I thought that. I was like, why are you calling this The Breakfast Club, man?
So we have a good time with that. I always say, people, you know, listen to me in the background. What everybody really comes for is the chat room. We have, it's kind of like the ITEL chat room. It's a very good, solid chat room with lots of people coming together, contributing. So while I'm sitting there playing my songs to the wall, that, you know, people are coming for the chat room basically, but it's a really fun show. And,
last week you did something about McDonald's, didn't you?
Yeah, we took on a McDonald's and looked at the history of the McDonald's franchise from a fourth generation asymmetrical warfare standpoint, and that's getting pretty good reviews. I think people will think twice before they buy a kid a Happy Meal, maybe.
Interesting. Back to the Hanukkah now, where we've talked to basically symbolism. How important is it for those who want to go to the next level of understanding about this war? Not everybody has to, but as far as a leadership position, how much, in your opinion, knowledge of symbolism helps you in decision-making and critical thinking?
Oh, invaluable. It's, you know, just learning that next level of communication. You know, first you learn your numbers, then you learn your letters, then you learn your words and your vocabulary and your sentence structure and communication. But once you understand these ancient symbols, it's like meta communication, where each symbol is kind of like a hyperlink. That's one of the things I love about the internet, is we can have these nested meta pages. So you write a paragraph about a subject, but you can put hyperlinks on each one of the key topics so that if somebody's interested in more information, they can always go to the next level. And so that's one of the key things about the Breakfast Club, is that idea of wake up, level up. It's like, here's the basics, and then proceed on your own pace, challenging your own cognitive dissonance of your own Overton window and trying to figure out how to do a show to create an audience base, a support base of peer review. That's the other thing about the Breakfast Club. We don't have, you know, Breakfast Club fans. We have, you know, a peer group that is basically contributing just as much as I am to the Breakfast Club. And,
well, you know what surprised me about that, you know, in support of that statement, I didn't know it until this week, quite frankly, is you got a fairly decent size, over 100 people involved in a Black, I heard it's not official, but a Blackbird Nines Breakfast Club work group on Facebook. I had no idea. That's a pretty healthy size.
Right. I found out about that as well, because I don't do Facebook. I don't have a Facebook account. People try to keep me to get on Facebook, but I found out that there is a study group on Facebook where people, you know, talk about the shows, and seems to be really popular. So that's
great. I had no idea. Yeah, I showed they posted one of my shows. I was like, wow, who, I didn't really realize you guys were there. I had no idea. So that's part of this what do we call it? Distributed network knowledge, to where it's, you can't stop the knowledge now. Now, we're involved in a war. We both, everybody, I think everybody that listens to this show anyways, and probably your show too, agrees we're in a war. We like to simplify it. We say Jews, 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 because there's no point in saying Jesuits, Illuminati. It doesn't help you. The temple, really, Hanukkah now. We're entering into Hanukkah. We're entering into the lighting of the menorah. My point here is that the menorah is a symbol of Jewish hatred of the West and a symbol of their victory over us, and we should start launching a very serious counter war against the menorah and take them down everywhere we see them through every legal means possible. Do you support that idea?
Absolutely, because when you learn what all of these Jewish symbols mean, and for the listeners, I am in North Carolina, United States, East Coast. I am in what is called the Southern States. We are ground zero and have been for a very long time in this culture war of Jews against Western civilization and against European descent peoples. They consider us Amalek, that, you know, we're the abomination basically that has to be destroyed in their worldview. And I'm constantly being told that as a white male, that I am this horrible person. I'm a Nazi. I'm a white supremacist, et cetera. And any of my symbols are hate symbols. Now they're even trying to make the American flag into a symbol of white supremacy and oppression, et cetera. But, and of course, you know, the Confederate flag or the Confederate battle flag is demonized. Just wearing a Donald Trump hat or a Make America Great hat is considered a hate symbol. So this is what the Jewish PSYOP teams are pushing, that, you know, everything associated with my history and my heritage is bad.
And before you could hear it, folks, we just want to remind you of the first hour when Frederick came on. Our theory here from a metaphysical realm is that Western traditions carried that ancient spark of light, that without it, we would not have a humanity we have today. And consequently, the Jewish people serving a very dark, sinister god, if you want to call it, daemon, jinn, whatever you want to call it, they are all about destroying this spark of light. And we are now in a battle existentially to preserve this spark. And that's why they're, in my opinion, Frederick, they're going after us. Because within our entire esoteric system remains this spark that they cannot squelch it without getting rid of us.
Exactly. And they demonize us and try to convince children that the symbols of their parents are bad, because that's the key target, is destroy the nuclear family of Western civilization, which is the backbone of Western civilization, that family unit. The Jews want goyim worker bees, basically, these asexual
drones,
basically, that, you know, do not have family structure. Their entire existence is dependent upon the state, the Jewish state. This is, I always say, communism was just Zionism in a red dress, where they want the centralized power system where everything is controlled by them, and depending on if you're a good slave or a bad slave, you either get something or you don't get something, rather than any type of independence. And we know that, you know, so much of Western civilization is always based about that family unit and that independence from these systems. And so that's the battle. And so to demonize my symbols while at the same time glorifying and deifying Jewish symbols, that suddenly it's okay and every church should also have an Israeli flag. Well, if you look at what that symbol of the Israeli flag means, that's nothing but a Jewish supremacist hate symbol. If you look at the menorah, that is nothing but a Jewish hate symbol.
Is the menorah and the lighting of the candle really a form of dark black magic on a mass scale?
In my opinion, yes. But it's also a very powerful propaganda piece, because one of the things that is fascinating to me is how recent Hanukkah is in Judaism. You did not have Hanukkah in any of the traditional pre-diaspora, you know, before 70 AD. Hanukkah, you know, didn't exist even after the Maccabees, because those stories basically were lost to Judaism and were preserved, ironically, by the Catholic Church. It was the story of the Maccabees that the church preserved. And so when the world Zionists started up with their globalist agenda, they basically took those stories back from the Christians and recreated this story of Hanukkah as part of the Jewish supremacist propaganda effort, not unlike the way that the Maccabees used the stories of Daniel and Esther as propaganda tools during the Maccabee revolt around, 2? Get this up again. Moving my timeline here.
Just want to remind everybody, you can join us in the chat room, InsideTheEyeLive.com. That's InsideTheEyeLive.com. Again, click on the live chat button. That will get you in the door. And if you'd like to call in and talk to Frederick, you can always do that. The telephone lines are working today, 323-275 323-275-1314. That's 323-275-1314 on the table today. Hanukkah, the spread of essentially Jewish conquest in virtually every little corner of our world, which is really what the Hanukkah means. Fred, did you find your place there?
Yes. So, you know, when you look at
how is that for a cover for you, man?
Thank you. While I tap dance, while you tap dance, while I look it up.
It's like a good time to get in that little promo for the chat room over there. By the way, just before you go, Frederick, don't forget, we are going to have a completely redesigned freedomslips.com chat room, everybody. I'm not sure. I'm sure Nighthawk, he's listening, so he'll tell me when exactly it's going to be formally released, or I'll get it in some type of note, and we'll pass that along to you guys, the listening audience. We certainly say support the network a lot because they support us, Frederick. Are you kind of surprised the network has supported someone like this show, an actual network supported a show like this?
You are a testament to shifting the Overton window, my friend, that you are able to put your show out there and get so much support has definitely been instrumental in shifting the Overton window in the new media. Because I think everything since the infamous Tuscan tussle, you know, that shifted everything in the alternative media, and suddenly we weren't afraid to use the J word anymore. And
I suspect that really was a turning point. And a lot of the stuff that today is actually bigger than you and I, quite frankly, without that show may not have been as easily impossible.
Right. And you and I are veterans of the troll wars after 9/11. And
yes, we are. Yeah. We were a product of that.
And, what we did really set the foundation for the meme war of 2016, and that worldwide shifted the Overton window and woke so many people up. I don't think the meme war of 2016 could have happened without the troll wars after 9/11. And you were definitely on the bleeding edge of that. I was on the bleeding edge of that. People like Mr. John Kaminsky, pretty much your guest list and my guest list of all these wonderful, brave people who stood up for truth and paid the price. You think of people like Mr. Michael Collins Piper, et cetera, those of us that, were standing up for truth, we really paid the price, but, we wouldn't be where we were today without those sacrifices.
Indeed. I forgot where we got lost before I went into this.
We were talking about, how the menorah story came in, and I was talking about how, Hanukkah did not exist in traditional Judaism. This is a Zionist concept that became part of the new modern, Judaism, after the diaspora, because the Maccabee tale is around 200 BC, and this was after Alexander the Great had basically set up the empire and established Greek Macedonian rule in this area. And of course, the Jews refused to follow Greek law. And what's key about Mattathias and his son, the Maccabees, was the ruthless nature of their warfare, where they not only went after Greeks, but went after Jews that they didn't think met their purity standards, much the same way as these modern Maccabees like the JDL and AIPAC and the Southern Poverty Law Center and all of these ADL. They will go after what they call self-hating Jews just as quickly as they will go after a Gentile. And it's just that ruthless nature of Judaism. And with Judaism, you have the thing called the Mishira laws, where it's forbidden for one Jew to inform on the crimes of another Jew, or else you face the wrath of the hidden hand.
Guys, I did a show on Mezra going back to 2012.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazes me, when I look back at my list of shows I actually did, boy, I actually brought a lot of information. When you mentioned Mezra, I'm like, I talked about that. I forgot about that.
You were onto this stuff way ahead of the curve.
By the way, guys, for those of you who don't know, it's against the law for any Jew to turn in another Jew, even if you know that that Jew is breaking the law within the country that they reside. So if a Jew kills another person, then that person is not Jewish. Well, then you just don't say anything because it's okay. Mesra would say that if you turn that murder into the local authorities, then the person who turned them in would now be subject to the law of Mesra, which means that they too would then be targeted for destruction by the Jewish community. So written within our Jewish community here are on their laws, wink, wink, don't ever talk, cooperate with the court. It's a veg. We got a half hour. Good set. And welcome back, everybody. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware. Today's date, December the 16th, 9 days to go before the Christmas holiday, the Yule festive, and all that kind of cool stuff. Another week or so, 6 days to go to the solstice. I want to really thank Frederick C. Blackburn from Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club and, of course, the sponsor of the ITEL Cat Report for coming on today to share some time and really kind of takes the load off of the Fetch here. But actually, Frederick's been doing some great work on his show. So, Frederick, thanks for coming back.
Always a pleasure. And for the newbies, it's an interesting little piece of trivia. You were the first one to interview me about my work with 9/11 Truth and NSA whistleblowing. Despite my best efforts to get any of the Jew media to listen to me about those subjects for years, and you were actually the first person to give me an interview.
Yeah, and we have to work hard at content, don't we, Frederick? We have to work. I mean, and it's not just us, it's our audience too. Everybody has to contribute to creating clicks, creating cum in the advertising world, creating I think cum is the only word I have right now, but really just creating velocity and spreading this message of what really is Jewish culture, Jewish society, and how it's warring against us. And of course, solutions. Like one very simple solution to me, Frederick, is begin campaigns to take down these menorahs, especially in towns where Jews are such a minority. Take back your victories. Go ahead, take the heat, but get rid of these menorahs. They are symbols of Jewish hate.
Yes, and all you have to do is explain very simply why that is a symbol of hate, just like these Israeli flags flying over U.S. soil, that those are hate symbols and war symbols. And yeah, that's the symbolism of flags. When you're hoisting a symbol over a capital, like the menorah in front of the White House or in front of the capitals of Europe. Yeah, that is a
Brandenburg Gate. That's an insult beyond measure, which Jews gloat about secretly every time they do it.
Right, and these especially Protestant churches here in the South that proudly wave these Israeli flags, with the American flag. That that is saying to me that Zionism has conquered the Christianity of that church, thanks to things like the Scofield Bible and all of this Holocaust propaganda, and also the Hasbro programs of Israel as our only friend in the Middle East, and the special relationship with Israel, and all these other propaganda terms. These are all hate symbols and symbols of Jewish supremacy.
I was just reading something here about Iran. Sorry about that. I was sidetracked. Sorry about that. So, yeah, we're talking about this hate symbol. What are you recommending right now that people do to start to wage a counteroffensive? And believe me, it's much better today, Frederick, than it was 5 years ago, 3 years ago. But what are you recommending to your listeners to do?
Well, I've always been a supporter of what I call the Starve Boz campaign, which is the Beast of Zion, is don't feed it. And so I'm very much a supporter of the boycott, divest, and sanctions against the criminal state of Israel, which is that was what it is. you know, Judaism, modern Zionism.
Okay, stop right there. Just no, that's a good point. Boycott, divest, and sanction. Every time we hear, like in the Oy Vey moment today, Jews calling for the sanctioning of another group, is it a time to raise that? Why are you against BDS then, against Jews in Israel?
Right, and just point out.
Should we immediately, in other words, hit them immediately?
Exactly. So,
are you saying it's okay to BDS then Israel because we don't like this because they're a symbol of hate and just use their language because they're, I don't know about you, but their language, it's very low class. One, it's inflammatory, it's derogatory, it's insulting, and it's designed to target with a type, it's designed to hurt its target audience. Is that, I mean, that's how I view it. You agree with that?
Exactly, because it's coming from a point of assumed superiority.
Yes, assumed superiority. It's so nauseating.
Jews automatically claim the moral, ethical, and intellectual high ground and argue from that position. Their arguments are always laced with Kafka traps, meaning they're putting you in a psychological puzzle where they play the eternal victim while at the same time they're being what I call a cry bully, where they are using passive-aggressive techniques, and this is all psychological warfare, where they say basically we are a victim class, and if you challenge us, then you're a bad person. You're another Hitler. You're a Nazi. You're a white supremacist.
Yeah, so one phrase and another phrase which I was dealing with on Twitter this week is you just blame Jews. You just blame Jews.
Right.
And it's like, well, aren't we in a time now where you guys need to start being blamed because who am I supposed to blame? The Chinese? Who am I supposed to talk about? You guys are in positions of responsibility. You're making the decisions. You're gloating about the decisions. And yet you don't want to take any credit for your actions. You don't want to be held responsible for your actions. At what point do we say enough is enough to that?
Right. And the other aspect is the Jewish tactic of pill pull, which was refined by the Frankfurt School as critical theory and all these other cultural Marxist techniques where the Jews say there is no such thing as objective truth, and so all of their arguments are just about winning the argument by any means necessary rather than trying to establish objective truth. And because they say there is no such thing, so you're going to argue with these Jews, and all they're going to do is try to put you in a position of disadvantage to make you look bad in front of the audience so they can demonize you.
Now, things are changing, though. So I think our advice here, Frederick, is look, the audience is now bigger on your favor. So you can start to fight back, and there's a lot more people going to support you than there was 5 years ago. So don't be afraid. Wake one more person up, and the audience grows again.
Right. And I see, you know, our strategy is got the benefit of an exponential component because – that one person is going to wake up nine people, and each of those nine people.
Yeah, it's the Amway model.
Right.
And use it. It's effective. They built a huge company just doing one by six, and then exponentially growing it. Find your winners, and they're going to grow it by who knows what. Another thing I've noticed, Frederick, is the idea of Jews targeting demographics within our security forces. The FBI is 67% white, and this doesn't reflect the demographic makeup of America, and this is wrong. We need to change our security, meaning the FBI, when we're looking at a 95% representation of Jews inside of, like, the media, 33% on the Supreme Court, 40% inside of Harvard. They sure seem to be very hypocritical people here, and we need to hammer on all of these points, but we need a lot of people to do it because they have a lot of people just dedicated to hammering on points all day.
Well, and I always say, you know, the litmus test for any master-slave system is the double standard. And this is a good example of Jews all over demanding equality, demanding multiculturalism, demanding diversity, except for in Israel.
Or their media. No, or just their media, too.
And in the media and in these Jewish-only gated communities, that, you know, you can have a Jewish-only community, but you can't have a whites-only community. You can't have a blacks-only community, but, you know, you can have this Jewish-only community because the Jews are, of course, you know, special somehow. They're this victim class that, you know, they get special treatment. But when you look at that, you know, that all rings of the Kalergi plan, and when you look at the history, 1923, Richard von Koenighoff Kalergi wrote the Pan America. And I just want to read this one part of this.
Sure.
I know we're running out of time here, but this is from the 1923 Pan America, which is basically a strategy that Kalergi proposed to Sith Lord Rothschild. And you think, you know, the inner circle of this Jewish international cabal is the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, the Moses Cohns, the Goldman Sachs's, you know, all these hidden hand bankster crime bosses, if you will, that, you know, he wrote this to Rothschild in the same way that Herzl wrote his Jewish state to Rothschild. But he writes here, "Therefore, I believe a wondrous generation of Jews will spring into existence. The Maccabeans will rise again. Let me repeat once more my opening words. The Jews who wish for a state will have it. We shall live at last as free men on our own soil and die peacefully in our own homes. The world will be freed by our liberty, enriched by our wealth, magnified by our greatness, and whatever we attempt there to accomplish for our own welfare will react powerfully and beneficially for the good of humanity."
And yet the sad reality is, for everybody paying attention, folks, Jews have never created anything beneficial for humanity. Wherever they go, genocide follows. And if you don't figure out Soviet Russia, Jews were instrumental in Mao. Look at Armenia with the Donma Jews. Look at what happened in the Ukraine. Look what happened to Europe in World War II. Don't buy into their propaganda. Isn't that a key message here? Stop buying into their propaganda.
You know, how can you tell when a Jew's lying? Their lips are
moving. His lips are moving.
And the other corollary of that is the only time a Jew ever tells the truth is when he's setting you up for a bigger lie later.
Yeah. Donald Trump in America, is he a net plus or a net loss right now for America?
Oh, wow. That is the question, isn't it?
Obviously, I'm not keen on it, and I've never been on his foreign politics or his foreign policy because it's basically Jewish run. He's no doubt about that. He's been very good at pulling in contracts for American defense firms, American companies. You have to give credit where credit's due. So I think that's a net plus there. But overall, net plus, net minus.
I see that I would have to go with the net plus just because of I project where we would be if Hillary Clinton had been elected. That I think the Jewish plan would be much further along. The multicultural white genocide agenda would have pushed much further along if the Clintons controlled the White House versus Trump. However, you have to acknowledge that, you know, he's going up against a Jewish power system that's very well established, very well financed. And I think the bigger net plus is the symbol of Trump to what his support base, you know, what the symbol of Trump means to them. Not so much as the actual man, if that makes sense, that these people who wear the Make America Great hats that are waking up and standing up, that the Trump president to me is a net plus there, mainly because of the grassroots awakening that's going on, even though we could both sit here all day and critique, especially Trump's foreign policy, because we know that the U.S. foreign policy is completely dictated by the Jews. That's part of the deal that's been in existence for a very long time, that the Jews control U.S. foreign policy. If you go to the U.S. State Department, all you're going to see is Israeli flags.
Israeli LGBT, you're a lot of basically homosexuals in the State Department.
So, hold on just a second, please.
Sure. All right, everybody, from North Kakalaki, North Carolina, again, it's Frederick C. Blackburn. Just want to say...
Mistake, didn't unplug the phones before I went on the air.
Okay, you're back so quick. Okay. Okay, so we say Net Plus, how's the immigration battle going on? Is this something that white America is now waking up to?
I think so, that people are seeing what is going on in South Africa. People are seeing what's going on in Sweden. People are seeing what's going on in the UK. People are seeing what's going on in France, and are understanding that these people are not coming here to take part in the great experiment of the American dream. They are coming here to basically go on welfare and, you know, it's for the Gibbs, as we say. They don't care. I hear a lot of people discussing, just whether or not these people that they're bringing in, because they're not bringing in the best and brightest.
No, actually, countries, what Americans need to understand, guys, they are dumping their trash on you.
You're right, they're emptying their
prison. And you're just allowing Jewish organizations to sit back and say, they are dumping their trash on you. Wake the frick up already. Trust me. The good people here aren't trying to leave, but the trash sure will.
All right. And, you're dealing with people that have nothing to lose. And they're coming here because the Jews are going to these countries and basically selling the idea the streets are paved with gold and you'll get, you'll live in a mansion and you'll have all the food and drink and women you want for the taking. Yeah, that's what America means. That's what Europe means. That's what, Germany means. And these people coming in, and they're stressing the social structure. They're stressing the law enforcement. And it's, again, that Kafka trap that I think Trotsky was brilliant in identifying the power of controlling the police. He always said, governments come and go, but the police remain. And so with these Jews in power over the police, and basically law enforcement's telling the local people, the law says you have to let these people in, and if you protest against it or you strike back, you try to protect your families, you try to protect your businesses, you try to protect your person, then the law is going to come after you. So you either sit there and learned helplessness and do nothing, or we're going to play whack-a-goyim on you. So much of, I think, a key area of our defenses and counteroffensive is to do liaison work with law enforcement, that that needs to change, or we're going to go the same way as Russia did during the Bolshevik Revolution, where 66 million people were killed in that, and it was basically the Jews telling the police and military, you either go do it to them or we're going to do it to you and your family. And again, it's that non-cooperative game theory that they play on military and law enforcement, that if you don't go out and attack these people we tell you to do and enforce these policies we tell you to, then not only are you going to lose your job, but we will come after you. And so that has to be addressed if we're going to make any progress at all.
Yeah, and in Austria, the People's Party and what's the other party? I forget the name of the other party, but they just made a deal, and the People's Party, which is considered quote unquote by Jews a Nazi party, they've actually gained control of the security and the police forces. So this is a very key win for the West when we can start to control our police. Should we consider those who use the slur Nazi as enemies and take names and just make note of this for any future conflict between if it really gets to the point where there's conflict?
Oh, I agree that, you know, if somebody is still using the word Nazi, that should be a red flag. Just like if anybody is still believing the official story of 9/11, that should be a red flag.
Yeah, and over 50% don't.
Holocaust. I'm sorry?
I said over 50% of Americans do not buy the official story. So we are the majority on this.
Yes. And so Nazi, of course, is a Jewish created psychological warfare term.
Should we consider it? Should we start to consider it a hate crime using their logic? And if you use it, it's a hate crime because you are intending to heap hate on the intended victim.
Oh, I totally agree. And I'm having fun here in Watauga County with the local university, Appalachian State University, where we've got this new chancellor carpetbagger coming in who is doing nothing but revamping the demographics of that university to make it more diverse, more multicultural, and is doing nothing but waging a hate campaign against the local culture and definitely anti-white, anti-male, especially anti-heterosexual, anti-family. And so this is what's going on at the local university. And then like so many states, almost all of our local newspapers here are not local anymore. They've all been bought up by these Jewish groups. All the newspapers here in the high country have been bought up by this Jewish group out of Minnesota called Adams Publishing Limited. And they're doing nothing but acting as the echo chamber for all of these multicultural diversity, anti-white policies that the university is putting in place. So they keep, you know, writing these fluff articles about how great this is. And it's basically the local paper and the local schools declaring war on the locals and just trying to bring in all of these. Here we have a lot of Mexican immigration, but you're also seeing a lot of Middle Eastern and African immigration into
this. I don't understand the African immigration. I mean, you can't even integrate the blacks you brought from 100 years ago and their ancestors. How in the heck are you going to integrate somebody from Africa today?
Right. Right. And that's the thing. It's like this system is not designed to work. It's designed to destroy the existing system.
Right.
And, what Saul Alinsky always says, the first rule of community organizing is community disorganizing. And Chabad Rabbi Manus Friedman always says the only way to fight a moral war is the Jewish way: destroy their temples, kill men, women, children, and cattle. Meaning, you know, destroy their temples, destroy their identity, you know, of who they are. And you do that by bringing in all these different cultures to change the demographics. So it's asymmetrical warfare under the guise of humanitarianism.
Do you notice a lot of nationalists out there aligning themselves with Jewish nationalists?
That's one of my big concerns, especially with the events in Charlottesville, Virginia. And for those not familiar, Virginia is the state to the north of North Kakalaki. And there was a huge event in Charlottesville called Unite the Right. And it set off just a wave of propaganda and demonization of white people because, of course, the Jewish mayor, the black supremacist assistant mayor, the black police chief, and the Hillary Clinton friend governor of the state all turned on those people, forced the police to stand down, let this thing happen, and then use the Jewish media to totally tell a different version of it, to demonize the nationalist. But at the same time, we have to really question the so-called nationalist leaderships that are all Jewish. It's like, you know, well, why would this Jewish man get, you know, wear this uniform, the stereotypical uniform of this nationalist thing if they were, you know, are they really supporting that agenda, or are they just acting as what we call a Judas goat to lead others into traps? And so that's the big question about Charlottesville, is how organic was it? How synthetic was it? And how much of it was electioneering, propaganda, psychological warfare to swing a key governor's race in Virginia? Because that's what got all of the so-called people of color out to vote, was the Charlottesville thing. Much like in North Carolina, our governor's race last year, it became this emotional issue about LGBT access to bathrooms. The great bathroom wars of North Carolina, this, you know, determined our governor's race. And
How stupid is that? It's such a hyper minority part of our population, and yet that is dictating politics at the state level. How insane is that?
Exactly, but it works. I mean, the manipulation of the electorate coupled with rampant voter fraud, it's real politics. And, you know, this is, you know, that Bolshevik Maccabee method of by any means necessary. These people do not have the same morals and conscience that we have. It's a different mindset. And I think part of our failings is thinking that everyone plays the same game rules that you're playing. These people are playing a completely different set of game rules.
Yes. And taking their ball and going home is one of them. When they start to lose big time, they'll just try to run away and hide from you. You know, right. They just want to just scoff you, blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, yeah, but you get out of my face. In some ways, their culture infuriates you to the point to where you want to use violence sometimes, doesn't it?
Right, but that is playing into the trap. And what is the old adage in the New Testament about send you out among wolves, you know, be as clever as serpents, but as gentle as doves, because, you know, if you use the sword, you're going to die by the sword. And if you break the law, you're going to end up in the cage, basically.
And with that, Frederick, you have filled in a great 2 hours. That's a tribute to continued success. Blackbird Night Breakfast Club, everybody. Check it out every Wednesday evening, 8 to 10 p.m. on Spreaker. And thanks again, Frederick.
Thank you so much. You have a wonderful Christmas. All right.
Thanks again. All right, everybody. See you all Thursday inside the I Live Primetime, 6 o'clock p.m. right here.